Good morning. Should UH Manoa change its protocol for announcing when a death occurs on campus? A professor thinks so and is circulating a petition to get the administration's attention. We'll talk with Susan Schultz later this hour. Meanwhile, on Hawaii Island, a council member wants to beef up the ethics board over the issue of P-cards. Margaret Willey joins us in just a few minutes. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. For 30 years, James Dooley wrote about the famous and the notorious as an investigative reporter. They're all there in his new book, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters. And Marta Lane is a Kauai-based food writer who keeps her focus on what's close at hand and close to home, educating the American palate in the joys of farm to table.
It's Tuesday, August 25th. Stay here for the conversation. Next, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
That whole P-card scandal sort of died down in the news cycle, but nothing changed.
Well, that's part of why one councilwoman would like to see some changes when it comes to the ethics board. We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, coming soon to the Hawaii County Council is a bill for a charter amendment that could mean a larger ethics board for the island, spurred by what Kohala Councilwoman Margaret Willey says is the inability of the ethics board to deal with the possible wrongdoing surrounding P-cards. The potential fix could be a larger board and a different selection process. That could mean going from 5 to 9 members and allowing council members to both appoint and confirm board members. Hawaii County Councilwoman Margaret Willey joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
Thank you for joining us. In looking at how to maybe reshape the ethics board, what makes you think that having a larger amount of members on the board, a bigger board, would translate into better opinions?
Well, that's really only part of what I see as a package of what we need to do. But right now, the person in the highest position, it gets to select and appoint the members of that board. They are confirmed by the council, but basically it's up to the mayor who is on it. And currently there are 3 members. They're all from Hilo. And there's the other, it's supposed to be 5. So what I'm trying to look at in terms of that point is to get people selected from more than one person so that you have sort of a divergence, and you would also have representatives from all 9 districts.
So the real issue with you is more the process than necessarily the number of board members?
Yes, but that would also deal with the quorum issue. I mean, like right now there are 3, and when the first P-card issue came up, one of those 3 members said, well, you know, I'm not going to be available coming up in the next month. So if we've got something coming up next month, just so you know, we're not going to have quorum. So we're just sort of walking on, 2 legs on a stool here. And that shouldn't be. I mean, we're trying to be accountable. But I would also like to add that I'm this is only one way that we can improve the situation. And when I say this situation, is that we want people to trust in government, and that we have a higher level of integrity and, eliminate opportunities for corruption or serious violations of the code.
But
so
you really...
I also have, I'm going to have it's actually amendments to Bill 78 proposed by Councilmember Gregor Ilagan. That would make it so that there'll be more record keeping of any exceptions to the standard limits, and would also include some prohibitions, and make that information available to the public at the Office of Finance, so there'd be more accountability. And I'm also going to bring forward a reprimand of Mayor Canoyer, so we actually do something here. And otherwise, it's like every county institution is just ignoring it or deferring it or referring it to some other entity.
So really, there are a lot of layers to what you're suggesting, but one of them is the issue of practicality, the fact that there are only three members now because perhaps the board's basic structure is too small. Did that come up in other issues besides just what's been happening with the P-cards?
No, I'm not sure. There have been a number of other issues that have come up before the board, and I know some of those were deferred a number of times. There was one other person speaking on an ethics complaint this past year, and I know it had been deferred numerous times. So,
and deferred because there wasn't quorum.
There wasn't a quorum.
So that's the practical element of it.
So that's another element, yeah. So we want, you know, how do we get more transparency and where it's functioning better and where there's actually some consequences?
On the issue of consequences, how much real authority would this board have to be able to levy some of those consequences?
Well, the board actually has considerable authority, whether it's even to suspend or to recommend suspension or actually removal of an official. But in this case, what they've done is they've said we're deferring any review until after the Attorney General looks at it, and that could all happen after Mayor Canoy is out of office. So that would mean that he would leave office and still nothing would happen, nothing would have changed. And again, it would be, well, I guess that's the way, looking at our government and why is it so dysfunctional.
Even with the board's ability to make a recommendation, does that have enough force behind it to carry it to the conclusion that you'd like to see?
I think the board does, but I want to go ahead with something from the county council and get at least a little closure and ask the council to say that under these circumstances that we're going to issue a reprimand, that we agree that this is wrong and that, that we don't accept these actions as not worthy of serious criticism, and that no one's above the law.
Will a reprimand actually do anything more than be a big slap on the wrist?
Well, I think we'll have to, it is a slap on the wrist, and it is a statement that we disapprove, and we don't even have that right now, other than individuals, but we don't have the prosecutor hasn't, he's deferred it. The ethics board hasn't done it. And so really it's only in terms of elected officials, it's the council. And so we just had the audit and the auditor made clear that these, were personal, purchases and were improper. And, I know the director of Department of Finance had said that he was advised not to use it for personal expenses and continued to do so. So I just think we have to act and then get on with it. So it is really, in a way you can see it's a slap on the wrist, but at least we're making a statement and not just sitting there on the sideline.
We talked with Councilmember Illigan not too long ago when he was introducing Bill 78. Are you working in concert with him now?
Yeah, so as he said, he started the conversation, so I've beefed up that. I have a communication right now, communication number 422.1, that would add more teeth to just saying that public funds shall not be used for private purposes. So
what's the next step with this? Because of not going to be on the same agenda as Bill 78, your proposal with the charter amendment change?
That's right. So it'll probably be in early October, I'm thinking. It won't all be right now. Everything has to get processed. And I waited to see what he was doing and for the audit before I taking any action. So now I've just as soon as it all gets processed, it'll go through.
You mentioned that obviously you've been having communication with him about his bill. Are you looking together to put together some sort of a package with the council that becomes much more of a statement than necessarily one bill might be?
I brought an amendment. I'm not working with Councilmember Ilagan, but I did discuss these at the council meeting when Bill 78 came up, and I'm not sure whether they'll come up at the same time, but that's my intent, to provide for more transparency and open government. And I think that's the way we help to make sure things, you know, the law is clear and that people apply the law and that it's enforced.
Would there be some virtue in working together to create some sort of bigger package, although you're not necessarily involved with his bill now, putting together more of a statement that might carry some more weight if more council members were involved?
Well, there's also sunshine law issues, so I'm, you know, it's not as easy as you might think. So I've got mine pretty much set, what will come up, and I think we work together at the council meetings, and we do a pretty good job of that.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment and see what happens as we go forward. Thank you very much for the time this morning.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Beth. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hawaii County Councilwoman Margaret Willie is working on a bill for a charter amendment. It would change both the selection process and augment the number of members on the island's ethics board. This all came up over the issue of the P-card. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's now 8:17. Coming up, the nexus of politics, law enforcement, and crime in Hawaii. First, today's backyard quiz.
Ulana, umau, ukaholave, uhavai.
This week in our backyard, there are many media personalities juggling work and rehearsals for this year's biennial Gridiron Show at the Diamond Head Theater. The locally produced show goes back to the early 1950s when the Honolulu Press Club put on a series of skits and satiric songs, as many press clubs do around the nation. Its roots come from Washington, D.C., where journalists founded the first Gridiron Club in 1885. Now that organization hosts the annual White Tie Gridiron Dinner in the Capitol, and every president since Grover Cleveland has attended. But back to Hawaii's show. If you're lucky enough to have a ticket to one of the sold-out performances of On Time and On Budget, you'll soon see why. Ticket sales benefit journalism students who get internship stipends from money Gridites raise with the show. And of that said, you might be wondering, why is it called the Gridiron Show? It's about politics, not sports. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Christopher G. from Miso and Ale. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show on hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
James Dooley spent a 30-year career as an investigative reporter in Hawaii, turning over rocks, filing stories about corruption and the hidden world where crime, law enforcement, politics, and entertainment overlap. The stories are all there in his new book, Sunny Skies, Shady Characters, and the cumulative effect is overwhelming. Most of its colorful characters are gone from the stage now, but a reader is left wondering, has organized crime in Hawaii simply dried up and blown away, or do we just not know as much about it these days? His book is a reminder of the value of fearless investigative reporting, and Jim is with us this morning. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
An awful lot of work went into this book, but it was day-to-day work over decades, yeah?
Yeah, it wasn't a whole lot of new work that went into it. It was sort of a summary or a memoir of stories that I had done in the past.
Yeah. And the memoir aspect deals with the whole thing of being an investigative reporter and the challenges thereof, which I think is a big part of the book.
I tried to include kind of backstories about how I got at certain subjects and how to go about finding information, and kind of a sort of a primer for maybe not just investigative reporting, but just reporting itself.
Well, this is a breed that we hope is kept alive in the future, you know, the whole thing of going out and find a story and take as long as it takes. But it's difficult to fit that type of job into today's news environment.
It is. The marketplace has changed a lot in the past 10, 5, 1 year. You know, it's ever evolving and kind of shrinking and changing into new forms.
One of the problems about investigative reporting is that not only are your stories unpopular with their subjects, but they can be unpopular with your bosses as well.
They can be. There's some built-in friction between reporters and editors on any subject, but particularly with investigative reporting. I used to joke that, you know, if somebody threatened to shoot me, that wouldn't alarm editors nearly as much as if somebody threatened to sue me.
Well, one costs a lot less than the other, presumably. You know, on the cover of your book, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 known convicted criminals.
Well, not all of them are not all are convicted, but
well, I mean, you have a total of that's what I mean. Of the 7 on the cover, 5 are criminals. 1 is the longest serving mayor in Honolulu history, and another is a businessman who's never even been charged with a crime.
Right.
And yet they're all sort of, there are links, obvious links there, right?
Yeah, they are. Mayor Fossey, that's sort of he. I got my start in investigative reporting with a story about him and his administration. In fact, coming to the studio today has kind of brought back a lot of memories, because this used to be sort of headquarters for the company that built Kukui Plaza, which was the subject of my first investigative series of stories about Mayor Fossey. Oceanside Properties was right down the street, and they built up several of the condos around here. But he was indicted and put on trial for corruption. As a result of the stories that I did, he walked away from that after the main witness against him, Hal Hansen, refused to testify. And the other is Larry Mayhew, who has been the subject of allegations and whispers and rumors of that regarding the so-called godfather of organized crime for as long as I've been here.
Yeah.
And once again, he's never been charged with anything, but the rumors persist.
So what does a reporter do about that when you can't corroborate a persistent rumor?
Well, you can only report, you know, what is known or what is said. When I was working at the Advertiser, there was a lawsuit that had been filed by a whistleblowing police officer that contained a great deal of information or allegations about Larry Mayhew. We went to great lengths to get that information unsealed in federal court, and did so. And the book contains those records, which the Advertiser didn't want to publish, and which I've included in my book. So you just kind of go with what you can find.
If there's nobody around, Jim, to do the searching, in what is admittedly an unpopular job that's unpopular with just about everybody. What happens if we don't have investigative reporting?
That's an awful question.
It sure is. Isn't it?
It is. I think all sorts of bad things happen. You know, that there's no one to check on government and business. Then they will proceed. Untrammeled without any concerns about the effect on the public or. So it's an awful question and an awful prospect.
But yet we are seeing an awful lot of discrediting of the press.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger generation says, I don't believe what I read in the newspaper. Those guys are all, whatever, corporate controlled. But there's the press has been tainted by a number of real life scandals.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Blair, Dan Rather at CBS, things. So the press has in some ways been undermined. Has it been crippled by changes in the perception of how the press works in recent decades?
I don't know if certainly the institution or the news media are not immune to the same foibles and ailments that affect every other institution. But it's not so much that kind of discrediting. It's really this sort of shrinkage of the institutions. Investigative reporting can be and is a very expensive process.
Yeah.
And you have to have somebody who's willing to front the expenses in order to get the benefit of the information at the back end. And that's there are not that many institutions that are pursuing that sort of work anymore.
And I guess the benefits are sort of intangible unless you really understand a lot of things about journalism.
That's true. That is true.
Well, here's hoping, right?
Fingers crossed.
Thanks very much. Your book is a terrific read. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
James Dooley is the author of Sunny Skies, Shady Characters, Cops, Killers, and Corruption in the Aloha State, published by the University of Hawaii Press. He'll give a Center for Biographical Research brown bag talk next Thursday, September 3rd at noon, and he'll hold a book signing at the Hukilau Restaurant on Wednesday, September 16th. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Bryn Butler noticed a lot when he lived in Cuba.
Kids in Havana were not told, don't talk to strangers, because there aren't strangers.
They still argue about Michael Collins more than 90 years after he was killed in the Irish Civil War.
He was the most wanted man in Ireland at one stage. He disguised himself as a nun to avoid capture.
And we'll look at how much New Orleans has changed 10 years after Hurricane Katrina on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
S is for sustainability. Listeners who become sustaining members know that providing the station ongoing monthly gifts allows HPR to plan and invest in innovative new ideas. We gratefully acknowledge new sustaining members Susan Bradford of Kihei, Tracy Hoffman of Arlington, Virginia, and George St. John of Mililani. Join them in sustaining HPR by calling 955-8821 during business hours or use the support link at hawaiipublicradio.org. The next conversation makes the point that statistics are often in the mind of the beholder. Data showing a 5% walkaway rate for furlough prisoners has detractors shaking their fingers and supporters shaking their heads. Civil Beat Deputy Editor Eric Pape explains in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Taking a look at how somebody can look at the same piece of data and say that that's a bad thing or a good thing really seems to be what's at the heart of this conversation about what's been going on with prisoners who are on furlough and those who just simply walk away and don't return.
Yeah, I think that how you look at statistics has a lot to do with what you already have in your head and what information you're bringing to it, especially if the statistics are partial. In this case, we're talking about the number of people who walked away from prison furlough programs. And so some people are saying here on Oahu, we have 20 people who just walked away, 20 prisoners just walked out. And some other people are saying, okay, we had 20 people who walked out. Only three of them committed other crimes. And if you look at that in a much broader context, then you're going to see that actually the program is doing very, very well and that it is preparing people for release. Because the basic logic of the furlough program is to help people to plan for the day when they get out of prison. And to pull up some other statistics, 98% of people in prison here are going to one day live to walk out of prison.
The point about the 20 walkaways, though, when some people see that number and think, wow, 20 walkaways, but the point is that that's only 5% of all the furlough participants on Oahu.
I actually think it's even less. I think it's 3.5%. And it is, I mean, a part of this is perception. There has been, up until a few years ago, they would only announce that people had walked away when they were found to be committing other crimes. I think it's since about 2013 or the end of 2013, 2014, they started to publicize every single person who walked away. So we in the media receive these notices all the time, and they get announced on television. And so now there is an impression suddenly that many more people are walking away when, in fact, that's not necessarily the case.
So how does that walkaway rate compare to the recidivism rate?
The walkaway rate is... Well, some people consider it to be very low and some people consider it to be troublingly high. But the recidivism rate, which is the reason that this program exists, is seen to be quite low. And that's the defense of most people who are in favor of the furlough program. The overall recidivism rate for parolees is about 45%. And that is not a particularly high rate, surprisingly. In many places, it's much higher. But that rate goes, I'm sorry, the overall recidivism rate is about 45%. The recidivism rate for people who are involved in this program is very, very low.
As this now backs end into the whole conversation about justice reinvestment and the Justice Reinvestment Initiative locally, how is this being seen as either support for it or a possible reason to tweak it?
Well, the people who are very concerned about this rate of people walking away would see this as a reason to tweak it to make it so that fewer people are involved in this program. Right now, there's a total of about 400 inmates participating annually in this, and the people who are in favor of the furlough program feel like there's proof of success and that there shouldn't be new constraints put on who is going to be admitted into the program. You shouldn't have to have a job because the whole point of getting people prepared for the day of their release is helping them to establish a work ethic, learn some job skills, and hopefully actually get a job so that when they get out, they can integrate into society.
But it's that job issue that has prosecuting attorney Keith Kaneshiro a bit troubled.
Exactly.
All right, well... It goes back to the point of how do you want to look at the data. Thanks very much, Eric. We'll talk to you tomorrow. And thanks for pinch hitting this week.
Thank you very much.
Eric, bye-bye. Eric Pape is the deputy editor of Civil Beat.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
A few weeks ago, a young man fell to his death on the UH Manoa campus. He was trying to keep another young man from committing suicide. Now a UH professor is again calling for a change in policy over how the school deals with death on campus. English professor Susan Schultz is circulating a petition to ask the school to be more consistent with, say, what happens on the UH West Oahu campus, and to sponsor more suicide prevention activities. Susan Schultz joins us this morning.
Thank you very much for being here.
Now, it's horrible to think about a 19-year-old who would want to end his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been made more horrible by the idea that a 24-year-old not only tried to save him, but died trying
mm-hmm.
to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So suicide prevention is sort of the underpinnings of all of this. But when there is a death on campus, what happens now at UH Manoa?
When there is a death on campus or the death of a student or faculty member off campus, some people are told, for example, perhaps deans are told, or perhaps people in the particular dorm where the student died are told, and they are referred to counseling. But otherwise, there's no information shared with the entire community. And so most of us found out about this latest death by watching the news. A year ago, a young man named Abel Pellegrino died after falling off of a dorm. And his death was never announced by UHM. It came out in the paper a few days later. There was no announcement. The only announcement of the availability of counseling came on Kaleo Online at about 8 o'clock at night, about 3 days later, with no mention of what it was related to.
This seems to bring up the issue that in some ways it's very comfortable to say we are a community, but in other ways it's very difficult to take action in that community when the issue that you're talking about is the death of someone within the school community. There is always the conversation, well, we need to let family know,
mm-hmm.
and we have to make sure that they don't just see this happening
right.
you know, secondhand. So
right.
why, though, can't there be sort of both of those
right.
avenues at the same time?
I'm not advocating for announcing exactly what happened right after it happened. Of course, you need to consult with family members and find out their wishes for how much information they want released. But to my mind, what you need to do if you're administration is you need to inform the community that something has happened. There's been a tragedy on campus, and if you feel traumatized, you need to go seek counseling. If you encounter a student in one of your classes or more than one of your classes who's been traumatized by this incident, then you need to refer the student to counseling or take the student to counseling. The reason I got interested in this was a year ago, after Abel Pellegrino died, I entered a classroom not knowing that anything had happened on campus the day before and encountered a student who was severely traumatized because he had been a witness. And in my next class, I experienced more than one student who was traumatized by this event because they had known him. I later found out that emails had been sent to Abel's professors, but his professor that I talked to didn't know him, nor did anybody in the class know him. I, on the other hand, who didn't know him, encountered students who were severely traumatized by the incident. So people like me need a checklist. What do you do when you're confronted by a traumatized student? Students need to know where to seek counseling. And the larger community simply needs to know that something on campus has happened.
How would you contrast what you've just experienced with what you might have experienced were you on a different UH campus, either Hilo or West Oahu?
UH Hilo, if you simply Google student death protocol UH Hilo, you'll find a beautifully done 6-page protocol, which starts with an expression of the need to share tragedy among members of a community. They have a protocol. It's written down. UH West Oahu has sent out emails to the community when a student has died. They have set up memorial services for the student. They also have a lovely feature, which is a monthly mental health moment where they send out explanations of, for example, what is a panic attack? What do you do? They also suggest that if you have a friend who seems to be in trouble, depressed, anxious, suicidal, that you talk to the counselor about your friend. So they have created a kind of network of caring at UH West Oahu that I think provides a very good model for UH Manoa.
Especially with what we know through the research that's been done of the mental health and mental illness of this age group in particular, young mm-hmm. adults. Are you at all surprised that this does not better inform what happens on the UH Manoa campus as opposed to what you've just talked about with Hilo and West Oahu?
Well, I'm kind of stunned. What makes me sad is I'm actually stunned when I see it done well. When I read the emails from UH West Oahu, I'm stunned because they're so good. That's really what surprises me.
And why aren't all the campuses consistent in policy?
I have no idea. You'd have to ask the president of UH that.
So at this point, you have the petition that's circulating, in part to get the word out that these issues need to be shared as a community. Timing can be the issue, but as long as it's
right.
done appropriately so that you don't become blindsided by
right.
those who are in need and feeling traumatized.
The petition has several elements. The first is you need to do better communication with the community. And another very important part of the petition is that you need to advertise student counseling at UHM, and you need to do some proactive suicide prevention. Not all deaths are by suicide, but many are, and you need to try to prevent the tragedy before you feel the need to suppress it.
As you mentioned, you entered into this issue over a year ago, and you've tried to have conversations mm-hmm. with administration. How far has that gone, and have there been any other results that you see as being positive signs?
Several concerned graduate students and I met last year with the then dean of students and the head of housing. And we had a long meeting, and then nothing came of it. So I tried in the spring several times to have another meeting. Nothing in the end came of that. After the recent event on campus, I corresponded with the chancellor, Blythe Roman, about it. And he indicated at one point he'd have something to say, and he did not say anything.
So at this point, you're just going to continue with the petition and try to make the issue come alive in a way that thus far it hasn't been able to. This must be greatly frustrating for you, having seen mm-hmm. and witnessed firsthand what it's like to have students in your class
right.
who are really traumatized, and others who may be even more so that you don't even know. But
I feel a little more patient when there's infighting at UH about things like reorganizing the departments or the colleges. I have absolutely no patience when people's lives are at risk. And right now, I think people's lives are at risk.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Susan Schultz is a professor of English at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She is circulating a petition. UHM administration develop student death protocol, mount suicide prevention activities. More about it is on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Good morning, I'm Tara from Humbug Outfit. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This morning, we tread the boards with Honolulu's Gridiron Show. The biannual satire of Hawaii news and politics takes over the Diamond Head Theater stage this week. It features a variety of songs and skits written by the cast, written by and performed by a cast of media extroverts, including a few found around these parts. It's hosted by the Society of Professional Journalists as a fundraiser to provide stipends for summer journalism interns. But back to today's question. We asked you why it's called the Gridiron Show. Now, most folks hear gridiron and think football. And although the show does get in some zingers whenever sports stories are deemed skit-worthy, the origin of the name goes back to 1885, when the Washington, D.C. Press Club founded the first Gridiron Club. Now, in those days, before radio and TV, newspapers were printed from movable type, which was placed on a large iron framework called, you guessed it, a gridiron. When football became widely popular in the 1890s, sports writers noticed that a football field resembled a gridiron and co-opted the name rather successfully. And we had no winners today, so we'll just keep our t-shirt. But if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com/HawaiiParents.
There's no doubt that the farm-to-table movement is taking hold across the country, but the American palate is a conservative one, and most of us stick to what's familiar. Marta Lane is a Kauai-based food writer whose mission it is to educate people about the joys of really fresh food. She's the author of Tasting Kauai 2015, an insider's guide to eating well on the Garden Island, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Marta.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, American, at least in the past, American food and the American diet was so bland that in a way people can be shocked by finding out what real food tastes like. Have you found that?
I absolutely have found that. I think tomatoes are a great example.
They sure are.
A lot of people don't like them anymore, but if you have somebody that you know that's growing them or you get them at a farmer's market, you fall in love with them.
Well, I mean, who knew they had flavor, right?
Right. Well, they've been bred and genetically modified for shipping and shelf life. So flavor doesn't really come into, you know, the picture.
A lot of grocery store food, at least back in the day, was, as you say, designed to last a long time while shipping, have good color. That's important, right?
Yeah.
But flavor somehow went by the boards. You know, salad could be hothouse tomatoes, flavor-free tomatoes, and iceberg lettuce.
Yeah.
Which was the only kind of lettuce you could find in the grocery store up till maybe 25, 30 years ago. Right?
Yeah, true.
So when you expose people to farm-to-table fresh food full of, you know, all kinds of intense flavors they haven't experienced before, not everybody loves it right away, do they?
I've been lucky. I haven't found that to be the experience.
Uh-huh.
I also do food tours, and a lot of people are apprehensive about the exotic produce that we have here. And as soon as they try, you know, a mango or a papaya that was grown, on a small farm,
mm-hmm.
That's not modified, they just fall in love with the flavor. It's just so vivid and pronounced and alive, and they really make connections. One of the tours I do is a farmer's market tour, and they just load up on all kinds of things they've never tried before, but because they've had a little sample and I've kind of demystified, you know, what it is,
mm-hmm.
They take it home or to their vacation rental and, you know, enjoy it during their stay, which it makes me really happy instead of going to the big box store and loading up on stuff that was, you know, imported 3,000 miles away. They're actually enjoying stuff that was grown here while they're here. And I can't imagine a more intimate connection to a place than eating what, you know, was just harvested yesterday.
Sure. And you would think it would be part of any sort of visitor experience. And it's certainly growing that way, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And I'm finding, too, that a lot of the restaurant, I'm working with a restaurant right now called Verde. It's a New Mexican. And they're really interested in bringing some local products to their menu. One of the things that they use frequently is spinach. But spinach does not grow well here.
Mm-hmm.
It can grow, but it takes a lot of work. And so we're playing around with different alternatives like moringa or sweet potato greens. And I had a couple little sweet potatoes that I got from the farmer's market about 3 months ago, and I didn't get to them fast enough, and they sprouted. So I threw them in my garden, and Maris is the owner of Verde, Maris and I have been kind of thinking, you know, what can we do instead of spinach?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, let me try these sweet potato greens that I have growing in my garden. And my husband and I had them this morning for breakfast with some taro hash browns and scrambled eggs. And they were delicious and really affordable. They grow like crazy here. So I think that, you know, that's going to be a real viable option for her to replace spinach with the sweet potato greens. And that's just one example of how we're trying to modify the menu to what grows here. But like you were saying earlier, I believe the American palate has been, like, monocropped.
Has been what?
Monocropped.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, flatlined. There's just a certain, there's not a lot of variation in the flavors that they're willing to experiment with.
And as a result, you see that reluctance in visitors, you're exposing them to new flavors. There's that little bit of, it's a hurdle to overcome.
Yeah. Yes. But I feel like they jump off the cliff on our tours because not only are they trying, you know, in a normal restaurant setting, you're there, there's not a real connection to the people. But on the tours that we do, we introduce them to the chefs. And they make a connection with how that food is grown, how it's made, the care that goes into it. And then they try it, and they're like, oh, I love it. Like, one of the things is lau lau. And everybody always says, oh, I never would have chosen that if I would have stopped here. But they're all like, this is amazing. I love it. I love taro leaves. You know, this is a really great food. So it's, I think it's about making connections and making it fun.
Well, it's you're fighting the good fight, Marta, because getting people to vary their diet is just an all-around good idea. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
You bet.
Aloha.
Marta Lane is the author of Tasting Kauai 2015, an insider's guide to eating well on the Garden Island. She's been a Kauai-based food and farm writer since 2010, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Institutions always have difficulty dealing with things like in this case of your discussion with Professor Susan Schultz, a suicide on campus and the death of a would-be rescuer. Institutions have a lot of trouble getting out in front of stories like that, but it really, disclosure always ends up being the best idea.
I think I would maybe modify that statement to some institutions have difficulty getting out in front of it.
True.
Because clearly by some of her examples, and including what happens at William and Mary College and others around the country, that's already set into place because, unfortunately, we know that with this age group that a suicide, unfortunately, we've seen the same thing happen here with Hawaii statistics, may very well happen. And how do you deal with those people who are left, who have been traumatized?
Yeah, and good to draw examples from those who have applied it before. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what happens. And I'm trying to get the answer to the question why all the campuses don't have a standardized policy with all of this. That's a mystery. Maybe we'll get an answer to that one. But for the moment, we're going to have to say goodbye because it's almost 9 o'clock. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to get a coral update with assistant researcher at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Greta Abbey is back.
And the Actors Group needs a few good men and women for a raisin in the sun.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like. That number is 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning back here for more of the Conversation. See you then.